here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, March 18th. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Dylan Law. You're listening live to News 101 on CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the unceded Musqueam Territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:04 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent, campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with third-year finance student Jason Kalire about participating in the 5 Days for the Homeless campaign.
Following that, we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph and News 101 correspondent Megan Devlin's report on the innovative language program taking place at Tsleil-Waututh.
Following that, News 101 correspondents Alex Kim and Stefan Labbé share a story on Tracy Morrison, a resident of the downtown East Side, and her Bannock stall.
Then we have News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman's weekly financial report, bringing you the latest financial and business news.
And to finish off our show, we have an episode of Talking Radical Radio, trans people supporting each other and pushing for change in New Brunswick. Host Scott and I talks with Reed Lodge and Mabel Wheeler about Fredericton gender minorities and transaction NB, New Brunswick. There are grassroots groups where the trans people are organizing in New Brunswick.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, Jennifer Birdall resigns from UBC Presidential Search Committee. Jennifer Birdall was one of the three faculty representatives on the committee tasked with finding UBC's 15th president. Birdall's resignation letter can be found on her blog. Birdall wrote, quote, "I have lost confidence in the willingness of the committee to hear the concerns of the faculty and to learn from the mistakes of the recent past to improve the future of UBC." In a UBC broadcast email, Chair of the Presidential Search Committee, Lindsay Gordon, said Birdall will be replaced by another Vancouver faculty representative. Gordon also thanked Birdall for her contributions to the committee. Gordon told the UBC, quote, "While I regret the reasons for her resignation, I do understand why she doesn't want to be on the committee anymore." On Wednesday, the committee finalized a long list of 16 candidates. They hope to finalize a short list by April. The committee will make a recommendation to the UBC Board of Governors following interviews in April and May. UBC plans to announce its new president by June 30th.
UBC Board of Governors finance chair avoided over $1 million in provincial taxes. In December 2015, the BC Supreme Court found that Greg Peet participated in a scheme to avoid paying taxes through his company, Vericity Capital. Justice George McIntosh wrote, quote, "This is a simple case of a tax not being paid anywhere which ought to have been paid somewhere." UBC insiders revealed the story in their March 16th investigative report. Peet is currently appealing the decision. Peet was the CEO of ALI Technologies, which was bought by a larger company called McKesson for $530 million in 2002. To avoid taxes, he consulted tax company KPMG. He was advised to create a new company in Quebec and BC and to shuffle taxable profit between them. Peet then created Vericity Capital, which claimed in Quebec that 100% of its gains were earned in BC. In BC, the company claimed that 90% of its gains were earned in Quebec, thereby avoiding taxes in both provinces. UBC spokesperson Susan Denard said, quote, "He's appealing the decision. It's still very much before the courts, and we're constrained by what we can say, but he'll remain a board member." Greg Peet is a provincially appointed member of the UBC Board of Governors and chair of board's finance and property committees.
In local news, BC teen sues a decade after mother's death in jail. A 13-year-old girl is suing the province, Caliber Health Services, and three nurses for negligence. The teen's mother, Shannon Piper, died at the Surrey Pretrial Center in 2005. The claim states that staff recommended her mother be replaced in the mentally disordered offender unit due to her history of mental illness. However, Piper was placed in the general population and assigned a work placement as a custodian in the shower area. 9 days after her arrival, Piper consumed a cleaning fluid and was moved to the health care unit. The nurse was told by poison control to send Piper to hospital if she showed signs of poisoning. However, despite showing these signs, she was never sent to hospital. Piper's daughter is suing for an unspecified amount for loss of support, household assistance, and love, guidance, and companionship from her mother. She is being represented by the public guardian and trustee of British Columbia.
BC teen dies while receiving help from Ministry of Children and Family Development. Patricia Lee, Indigo, Ivoy, is the third First Nations teenager to die while receiving support from the ministries since 2013. Ivoy died March 10th in Burnaby, along with an unidentified male. The cause of their deaths is still under investigation. Ivoy started receiving assistance from the ministry when she was 18, but aged out of the system when she turned 19. Her friend Michael Holliston said, quote, "The system treated her the way it's treated many others. There are children falling through the cracks that need their services." Ivoy was living in an apartment run by the Vancouver Native Housing Society, but fell behind in rent after spending a month in the hospital fighting off an infection. Holston said, quote, "This tragedy could have been avoided if the ministry made radical changes that were recommended." After the death of the 19-year-old girl in 2013, the BC government promised to form, quote, "rapid response team to reach out and directly access the needs and safety of the highest risk youth." However, in 2015, 18-year-old Alex Gervais fell or jumped to his death from a room in an Abbotsford hotel where he had been living alone after the province closed his group home. His death is still being investigated. There has been outpouring of grief for Ivoy's death on social media. Holston hopes her death will result in real change.
In national news, sexual assault survivors to get free legal advice in Ontario. In a Canadian first, Ontario is launching a $2.8 million pilot project this spring. Survivors in host cities, Toronto, Ottawa, and Thunder Bay, will be offered 4 free hours of legal advice. The program is meant to empower and inform people of their legal rights and options. Amanda Dale, executive director of the Barbara Schieffler Clinic, which will host the Toronto pilot, said, quote, "At this stage, what we're really looking for is to level the playing field a bit, for the claimant to understand the process in a clear-eyed way, to give women somewhat adequate support and awareness of the realities of the criminal system." The hope is that the data from the pilot will lead to a provincial-wide initiative. The project is part of Premier Kathleen Wynne's It's Never Okay strategy to combat sexual violence and harassment. With the highly publicized trial against Jean Gomeshi, there's been increased awareness of the adversarial nature of the court and police systems towards survivors. Dale said, quote, "We're taking baby steps at this point to try and rectify the brutality of this process."
Brock University faculty demand changes to sexual harassment policy. Following an investigative report by CBC, 74 faculty and staff at the university have signed an open letter to the school's president, Jack Lightstone. The letter calls for a number of changes to how the university handles sexual harassment and assault. This includes a commitment to resource a human rights office, a clear survivor-centered process for handling complaints, and clear instructions for the faculty, staff, and students when a complaint is made. Associate Professor of Women and Gender Studies Margot Francis, who helps organize the letter, said, quote, "I think it's really critical that survivors know when they report something will happen." The letter comes off as a campus demonstration on Tuesday, attended by over 60 students. Last Friday, the CBC investigation revealed that Brock warned a former student to keep quiet about an internal investigation that a professor attempted to sexually assault her. The student stated in the report that history professor David Shimapenik van der Ooy gave the student alcohol and attempted to sexually assault her in October 2014. He continued to teach at this university until 2 weeks ago. President Lightstone addressed students via Facebook and wrote, quote, "We regret the emotional trauma this incident has caused to the complainant. It is important that you all know that Brock's staff were supportive and responsive as soon as they learned of the complaint. The complainant responded on Facebook saying that she was insulted by the president's statement, noting the claim was not handled quickly or effectively. She wrote, quote, "For 113 days, I spent all of my time refreshing my email, hoping that I would have an update on what was happening. I nearly failed out of the program I am currently in, and more importantly, I nearly lost my mind."
In international news, North Korean tourist jailed for 15 years after attempting to steal a propaganda banner. University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier was arrested after he attempted to leave the country in January. He later made a televised confession that he tried to take a propaganda banner from a hotel home as a trophy. The 21-year-old said he took the banner for a friend who wanted to hang it in her church. North Korea's state news agency, KCNA, said his offense was, quote, "pursuant to the U.S. government's hostile policy." Warmbier has been convicted under an article of the criminal code dealing with subversion. The U.S. has urged the regime to immediately release the student. A White House spokesman said that North Korea is using U.S. citizens as, quote, "pawns to pursue a political agenda." This is not the first time a foreigner has been given a lengthy prison sentence in the DPRK. Last year, Hyun-Soo Lim, a South Korean-Canadian pastor, was sentenced to a life of hard labor for crimes against the state.
Paris attacks fugitives arrested in Belgium. After a four-month search, police have captured Salah Abdelsem in the Brussels neighborhood where he grew up. Abdelsem and two other suspects were detained in a raid Molenbeek, where he was shot in the leg. Abdeslam's exact role in the attacks is unclear. The Paris attacks on November 13th killed 130 people at a rock concert, the National Stadium, and cafes. French President Francois Hollande congratulated the Belgian government for their operation and said authorities will continue to pursue anyone involved in financing or organizing the attacks. Two other people linked to the attacks who are still being pursued include Mohamed Abrini and Soufiane Kaal. Many of the attackers died on the night of the attacks.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Ugh.
Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from the unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Right now, we have my interview with Sauder student Jason Collierai about the 5 days for the homeless campaign.
UBC Sauder students are spending 5 days and nights camped out in front of the bookstore. They're hoping to raise awareness about homelessness in Vancouver through the 5 days for the homeless campaign. They also hope to raise $10,000 for Directions Youth Services. I spoke with third-year commerce student Jason Collierai about the campaign and what his experience has been like.
So right now you're doing 5 days for the homeless. Could you tell me a bit about that?
So it's a nationwide campaign across 26 schools. 26 schools. Basically, we're just trying to raise awareness for homeless youth. We're trying to develop empathy for what living conditions may be like, but we completely understand that it's not an accurate representation. It's just our attempt at trying to spread the message and make like a visual representation of bring it closer to home, because UBC, the area, it's so easy to live your whole life, especially if you're on campus, and not explore the east side of Vancouver. So it's kind of bringing it right into the heart and getting some exposure.
So how many students are involved in this?
This year there's 8 participants, and there is 4 people in the managing team, directors, coordinators, and whatnot.
So do you stay here the whole time for the 5 days, like overnight and everything?
Yeah, 5 days, 5 nights. We're here, we sleep here, but we still go to our classes and whatnot, and we alternate shifts at the site just to keep promoting for our organization that we're fundraising for.
And have you personally done this before?
No, this is my first year doing it. This is the first time I actually heard of it, because I was a transfer student. But yeah, I just thought, what the heck?
And why did you personally want to do it?
Recently, since the fall, I've been trying to volunteer my time more often. So at any opportunity, I kind of just jumped on it. I was pretty hesitant, to be honest, at first. I was doing my application, but then I just sent it. I was like, let's do it.
And what has the experience been like so far?
Really awesome. Like, pretty dope. Just like the intentions you have going in are like, you just learn so much. You change so much as a person as to what the cause, what you're really doing here, and how much more we could do. Just like our organization, Directions Youth Services, is a stepping stone for homeless youth to go and find what needs they need to be served. This is like our stepping stone into finding what else we can do to actually make more of an impact. I feel like I've learned a lot, and through my blog posts on the 5days.ca, I just feel like I've been developing more as a person, and we have like a notebook full of ideas we want to push more and more.
Has it been difficult at all?
I don't want to say it's been difficult. Like, it's just, there's something, it's going to be cold. You're going to be cold, like, that's it. But it's nothing to complain over compared to what the cause we're trying to draw attention to. Like, we don't want to focus on us. We want the focus to be on who we're doing this for. So, no, it's not difficult.
Could you talk a bit about who you're raising the money for?
Yeah, it's an organization downtown called Directions Youth Services. They're located right across the street from St. Paul's Hospital. Basically, they act as a base of first touch for homeless youth, so that they can, first of all, satisfy their basic needs, like taking a shower, getting laundry done. They can make phone calls, because some of them are runaways just from home, and they just want to go back, so they can arrange a bus ticket, or some have addiction issues, so they can be then referred to further resources to serve whatever needs they might have. They also serve meals once a day, with food of which is only 80% of it is donated. So donations are a huge part of this organization, just to keep it going.
And what is your goal? And do you know how much you've raised so far?
Our goal this year for the campaign is $10,000. So far, last time we checked was been last afternoon, and it was just over 2,000. But really, the goal is just to create awareness. Like, money, of course, is great, but getting the word out there is what's more important, getting more people to acknowledge what's going on. That's also part of why we decided to change the location this year. So before we were at Irving, which is more of like student-based, but now we decided to go at the bookstore, which is more of the whole UBC community.
And so your setup here is like sleeping bags on cardboard. Where did you get all this stuff?
So sleeping bags, backpacks, all that was brought from home. Cardboard, we actually went through recycling bins for around the campus, and we did that the first night right before we got to set everything up.
And in terms of the food that you're eating, is that something that you're buying, or is part of the experience that has to be donated as well?
Totally part of the experience. We're taking food only through donations. All the money that we do collect for fundraising is 100% going to Directions Youth Services.
And what has the reaction been so far by people passing you by?
Super positive. Yeah, we've met some really interesting people. even, in fact, one person in the bookstore named Sandra, she came and talked to us about her experiences of helping the homeless youth for over 20 years. And she just gave us so much insight. And we have, like, security guards who've been talking to all the campaign participants in the past years just about all their experiences and just other people who are involved around the community and, like, what ideas they have and what their plans are.
So I know there's been some criticism of activities like this. For example, Gwyneth Paltrow did, I think it was called the food bank diet, and people were really criticizing, you know, she did it for a short period of time, but then she can go back to her life. What would you respond to that kind of criticism?
To that type is, what we want to stress is this is not an imitation of homelessness. What we're trying to do is just raise awareness that this is a thing and it exists and it's becoming worse and worse. Like, I can remember from when I was a kid, being driven around on the streets, if you see a homeless person, there would be a much smaller percentage, and they would typically be older, like at least 40 years old. Now when I drive the streets, I can see like people my age, mid-20s, and it's like, what's changed? So it seems to be more of the issue's growing, and just more attention needs to be drawn to it.
And has your group talked at all with the organization that you're raising money for or the type of people that it's hoping to serve?
Yeah, in fact, about 2 weeks ago, we got to actually get a full tour of the place and talk to one of the, I can't remember his position, but he organized it and gave us a full tour and told us about what it was about. The type of people they aim for is to help is youth 24 and under, targeting them and just trying to give them the stepping stone to get back into, like, to settle back into their lives or however they need help, because everyone's situation is so different.
Thank you, Emily. Now we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph and News 101 correspondent Megan Devlin's report on the innovative language program taking place at the Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
There are three people, including myself, that I would recognize as conversant Unkwamitnam speakers. Our language is at a critically endangered state. The programs that we are running to revitalize the language are crucial. If they're not successful, the language could be gone within 20 years. I'm Victor Guerin. I'm a conversant speaker of Unkwamitnam, also known as the Musqueam dialect. It's a dialect that was spoken on the lower Fraser River and all around the shores of Burrard Inlet in pre-contact time.
Tali, Sin, North Vancouver.
Tsleil-Waututh is in North Van, just a little ways from the Second Narrows Bridge on the Dollarton Highway. The community is perched up on a hill, and there's the Burrard Inlet down below. The name, Tsleil-Waututh, is the people that are in the bay.
Our children were taken out of their family situation and put into a residential school where they were forbidden to speak their language, forbidden to practice their culture.
Queen Smant to E.
Awa, a Queen Smant. The Smant to E.
And so Wear Your Keys is a method of kinesthetic teaching that involves American Sign as well as a set of tools that are fluid. So, for instance, you don't use your dominant language. You have to stay in the language that you're learning all the time.
It gets at people on a more intuitive level so that they learn to think in the language rather than learning to translate from English into Unkwamitnam.
Be smart.
These man to eat.
We have a technique that we call mumble, where we don't expect our learners to pronounce words perfectly at the very beginning.
Stem ah.
Stem ah.
Stem ah.
Stem ah.
But you can say stem claw until you get used to the clicking.
Doing the Wear Your Keys piece was just like, my brain exploded. It was just so much fun. And it's the first time that I've had that much fun with language, well, ever.
Who else can say that they've helped a dying language come back and teach it to the rest of the whole community?
Thank you, Megan and Rohit. Now we have a piece by News 101 correspondents Stefan LeBay and Alex Kim on Tracy Morrison, who sells fried bannock in the downtown east side.
Oh, I didn't even see you.
Oh, yes. I don't even know if I introduced myself really to you guys.
My name is Tracy Morrison. I'm an Ojibwe woman from northwestern Ontario, and I've been here downtown Eastside for since 96.
I got butter, I got jam, and I got cinnamon sugar. For a dollar.
It's nostalgic, actually, for here in the downtown Eastside. What I bring to people is stories of what they remember from their childhood or their auntie or their grandma or their mom, right? They remember these things and it makes them feel good. Water can't be too hot or else it'll fry the baking powder. Nope, not yet. The trick is mixing the dough and then making it into a big piece of dough. It has to be, sorry to say, but it has to be like the, if you touched a woman's boob, it's about that soft. If not, you're screwed. I make them nice so they're golden brown, and sometimes I make them a little golden brown so they're a bit crunchy on the outside and soft on the inside, but most people like it the way he does it. He's got it down. You need a bag, right?
Yeah.
Tom, can you hold on?
Oh, thank you. No. Cat's meow with peanut butter. Bag.
Yeah. There you go.
Cat's meow with peanut butter.
Yeah.
Sounds
like thank you. McQuitch. I can't believe we just got here. Freaking already done. I think that was record time. Thank you. Okay. See, it doesn't really matter if she's in here or not. So we all sell out.
I'm going to have to run up and get more supply.
Okay, here.
So do you want two flour? One
to me, it's about the money, but it's not all about the money. I sit here and I talk to people. I say, hey, how's it going? You know, and I genuinely care about the people. Some people, even the elders, say, this is sick land, meaning it's bad lands, right? I'm like, yeah, it could be, but you know, how sick can it be when this is where I found compassion, friendship, family, love, hope, faith in people. This is where I found it. This is the best neighborhood in the whole world, I swear, it is.
Thank you, Stefan and Alex. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributing segments.
For over 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country. Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved with Discorder.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory, here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have trans people supporting each other and pushing for change in New Brunswick from Talking Radical Radio. Host Scott Nye talks with Reed Lodge and Mabel Wheeler about Fredericton gender minorities and trans action in New Brunswick. There are grassroots groups where trans people in New Brunswick are organizing.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people that are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I will be speaking with Reed Lodge and Mabel Wheeler. Transgender people are people whose gender identity does not match the gender they were assigned at birth. The range of ways of experiencing, identifying, and living gender within that is enormously broad, including, for some people, ways that push beyond the rigid binary that structures dominant understandings of gender. Trans people often experience severe social stigma and are at heightened risk of interpersonal violence, especially trans women of color. Trans people face barriers to accessing employment, housing, and other services, including healthcare services, and this is true in terms of gaining access to the gender confirmation surgery that can be an important part of transitioning for some trans people, but it is also a factor in accessing general health care. As well, getting state-issued identification that correctly communicates their gender can be a tremendously difficult process, and not having such ID can put people at risk. These things and more are true across the continent. But there is variation, and according to Reed Lodge and Mabel Wheeler, New Brunswick is one of the Canadian jurisdictions with the most work still to do. The province does not even have a major nonprofit that spans the entire LGBTQ acronym, let alone funded trans-specific services, so it can be incredibly difficult for trans people to find safe spaces, supportive professionals, or even other trans people to talk to. Also, New Brunswick has no human rights protection for trans people, and it is currently the only province that does not fund gender confirmation surgery through Medicare. On today's show, Lodge and Wheeler talk about two different grassroots groups through which trans people in New Brunswick are organizing collectively to survive and thrive. One is Fredericton Gender Minorities, which aims to support trans people, to create spaces for mutual aid and support, and to engage in educational community outreach. And the other is Transaction NB, a smaller group with a more explicitly activist orientation that engages directly and politically with questions of government policy, barriers to healthcare and services, and so on. Lodge and Wheeler speak with me about trans experiences in New Brunswick and about the work of Fredericton Gender Minorities and Transaction NB. We spoke by Skype from Fredericton.
I'm Reed Lodge. I'm one of the co-chairs of Fredericton Gender Minorities. Been co-chair for about a year now.
I'm Mabel Wheeler, and I'm also one of the co-chairs of Fredericton Gender Minorities.
And what pronouns do you use?
I use she, her, hers pronouns.
And I use he pronouns. Fredericton Gender Minorities was started in 2012, and over the past couple years, we've really grown in size. We have a lot of regular members now, so it's kind of a central group for the trans community in Fredericton.
For trans folk, there's no real support network in a lot of places, especially in New Brunswick. With where our healthcare is right now, basically, we have a lot of officials and politicians and doctors saying that they disagree with our quote-unquote lifestyle. So that puts us in a really negative light for a lot of people, especially a lot of people who would be creating safe spaces for us to navigate through the world. So for a lot of trans people, they have to create their own support systems and their own support networks. And unfortunately, that's something that's really common, and it's also something that we had to do here in New Brunswick.
Before the Ferguson Gender Minorities group got started up, we really didn't have any group specifically for trans people in Fredericton. So a lot of people had been going to the university group Spectrum, which there are some really lovely people in Spectrum, but it's not a group that focuses on trans issues, and trans people in the group were having problems with other group members. And then there ended up being a very dangerous sort of assault situation. And we decided, okay, like we really need to pull back and create our own space where we can talk about issues that affect us without being at the risk of cis people's opinions about us. So that was really one of the main reasons why the group itself got started up. And then as I personally got further into my own transition, I kept encountering a lot of the common barriers that other trans people face. They're trying to navigate name changes or gender marker changes or healthcare and other things like that. So I, as my own transition went on, got more and more involved in the group because I really felt like it was necessary that we started to address some of those problems. I actually wasn't one of the main people involved in setting the group up. I went to the first meeting, but it was a couple other people in the city who got the group together. And we were just using a space that was given to us for free by FSAC, the Fredericton Sexual Assault Crisis Center. So we met there a few times. The first year or two that the group was together, we didn't really meet regularly, and we didn't really have an organized system where we were trying to address specific problems of the government or anything. We were really just kind of getting together and figuring out what we even needed to address. Actually, when the group started, the aim was to explore different theoretical perspectives of gender and power dynamics within gender. So we did have a bit of a growing period where a lot of people in the group had some very different opinions from each other as to what was important to talk about and how they conceptualize power structures. So yeah, like the initial discussions were around things like which trans people have power, how trans people may or may not be oppressed, really just general stuff like that, and kind of exploring what other information was out there. Because for a lot of us, we really hadn't had the opportunity to talk about that with anyone else before. So it took a while for us to settle into a group that was really specifically oriented around supporting trans people and helping trans people to gain access to things that they might not have been able to locate on their own. After that initial realizing that we could create a community and getting to know each other, then we started to meet weekly and started to talk about how we could help trans people access healthcare or access name change information and stuff like that. So over the past 2 years, we've really grown a lot.
So for listeners who maybe are new to some of these issues, lay out some of the barriers and challenges that are commonly experienced by trans people.
One of the biggest things that comes to mind immediately is the healthcare barrier, especially in New Brunswick. So New Brunswick is the last province in Canada that does not cover gender confirmation surgery under healthcare. Gender confirmation surgery is extremely medically necessary, and having that barrier forces trans folk to move out, puts their lives in danger, greatly increases risks of all sorts of awful things that can happen to trans folk when they're not humanely properly treated. We're spending a lot of money at the government level treating trans folk in a way that's not really hitting the mark, right? So treating them when they come in after a suicide attempt, or treating them at addictions after they self-medicate, or treating them through our mental health care system when their mental health gets really bad because they haven't been treated. So that's one thing that's happening. Another thing that had happened is that our health minister, Victor Boudreau, had released a statement in the Telegraph Journal, which is a province-wide paper that we have here, about doctors and trans folk. He said that doctors shouldn't have to treat trans people at all. They could refuse them service if they had a moral or religious discrepancy with their quote-unquote lifestyle. That put trans people in a really dangerous place as well, because now trans people were being denied healthcare at all, right? So there's a lot of things that happen with trans people in healthcare that they can't go to a hospital and get treated because they're mistreated. because of the fact that they're trans, or they might not be treated at all and have to be bounced around from doctor to doctor, even if it's something that's really urgent. If you don't know about the Fredericton gender minority group and you don't have anybody in your life who's trans and you try to navigate, say, Victoria Health, which is our mental health center, you almost always come across transphobia and mistreatment at the hospital. You almost always come across mistreatment. But if you need mental health care, you do have to go through Victoria. And I called them the other day, for example, and I said, here's my name. I left them a message 2 times with my name, and I introduced myself as Mabel on the phone. And he picks up, and he's calling me Mabel, tells me to read off my Medicare number, and then starts calling me by my old name. And I explained to him, which I should not have to do because it's something that's extremely difficult, I explained to him why it was inappropriate to call me by my old name or my dead name, and he was like, yes, okay, and continued to call me by my dead name. And so when he gave me an appointment, I said, I need a transpositive doctor so that I'm not mistreated. And he said, oh, don't worry, dead name, nobody here would be transphobic. So he was being transphobic while telling me nobody was going to be transphobic, and then went on about how liberal the doctor that I was about to see was. So this kind of interaction can really make it seem like it's impossible to receive healthcare if you don't have insider connections and know who to go to and have like the yellow pages of transpositive doctors that people have scoured for in the system, right? And if I wasn't at a place where I'm lucky to have some support. I have everybody at the Gender Minorities Group and Reed and this close-knit support that I made myself, I would have hung up the phone and I would have never gone to Victorian because that's not a good sign, right?
I mean, just in terms of accessing transition-related care, we face a lot of barriers here, but we also face barriers, like Mabel was saying, accessing like emergency care or just general health-related care that doesn't have anything to do with our transition. And then if you experience a health problem that has to do with one of your reproductive organs and your chart says that you're trans, people have also been denied service based on that. So even if the surgery is for something like cancer or to remove a cyst or something, sometimes they still will be denied just because their chart says that they're trans. So apparently that means that any surgery that has to do with reproductive organs is transition related, according to Medicare. So that's another thing. And then on top of that, I mean, underemployment is already a problem in New Brunswick, but for trans people, it's definitely a lot worse. A lot of trans people can't find jobs here. We don't have human rights protections that protect trans people in employment or in housing. So trans people are also denied housing. It's really, in general, just a mess if you're a trans person in New Brunswick.
Right. And all those things can stack up, so they also lead to poverty. And there's a cycle that comes along with that, right? And another thing on top of that is trans people have been refused service at stores, at just normal places doing normal things that don't have anything to do with their transition or their health or going through vital statistics. But another thing is that you need to have quote-unquote transsexual surgery in order to have your gender marker changed on your government-issued identification, which puts trans people in a really dangerous place because of the fact that if they're confronted by the police, there's a discrepancy. If they are buying alcohol or going to a club, they're outed, and maybe their identification looks nothing like them, so they can't get into the club. Or I traveled through an airport a little while ago, and I was searched numerous times because my body was a... what do they call it?
Anomaly,
yeah. It's quite funny at first, but then it happens over and over again, and you're like, oh, they actually think I'm an anomaly. These things are both dangerous and mentally taxing, right? So there's two things that go along with these, is that every single bad thing that happens to trans folk around our area because they're trans is bad initially because of what it does to them or what it prohibits them from doing or accessing. But it's also terrible because every single time this happens, it's impacting their mental health.
So given this dense cluster of issues and challenges and barriers, once the group decided that it wanted to start tackling them, how did you start?
Recently, we've taken Fredericton Gender Minorities and gone more in a direction of making it a supportive space for trans people. So we don't actually have meetings with Fredericton gender minorities where we tell people to go out and do certain things in order to make change. Because a lot of the time, these people are already struggling so much just to keep up with their own lives and to get through what they're going through because of the barriers they face. So really what we do with Fredericton gender minorities is we bring trans people together and encourage them to support each other. And a lot of the time that results in them feeling confident enough to go out into the community and do things on their own that are positive. And Mabel and AJ Ripley and Aaron Fredericks and I actually now also run Transaction, which is the more activist focused group that we have here. It's a lot smaller, obviously. There's only four of us. And we release press releases that respond to government decisions that affect trans people. Or we share news articles, and we also have been working with the NB Trans Health Network to meet with the Department of Health and talk about what can be done at a policy level to change things.
What kinds of opportunities for support does Fredericton Gender Minority?
Thank you to Scott and I and Talking Radical Radio. You can listen to the rest of that episode on Talking Radical Radio. To finish off this week's show, we have Alex Norman's weekly financial report, keeping you updated on the latest financial and business news.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. Canada's inflation rate slows in February. TransCanada announces a $10.2 billion purchase. SNC-Lavin confirmed job cuts. And Valiant's credit woes continue. We begin today's news with a report from Statistics Canada showing that the nation's annual inflation rate slowed in February. A drop in gasoline prices pulled inflation away from the midway point of the Bank of Canada's target. Annual inflation was 1.4%, downgraded from analysts' expectations of 2% from January's consensus. Gasoline prices were the biggest driver of the deacceleration. However, prices still rose in six out of the index's eight major categories, led by a higher cost for food and shelter. On average, Canadians paid 3.9% more for food compared to this time last year, with higher costs for fresh fruit and vegetables contributing mostly to the increase. Shelter costs also rose by 1.2% over this time last year. This next song request goes out to TransCanada Corp. It looks like TransCanada Corp is a big spender of the day with a $10.2 billion purchase. The Canadian company is buying Houston-based Columbia Pipeline Group for $10.2 billion U.S. The acquisition will give the Canadian company a major position in shale gas production in the northeast region of the United States, where it faces stiff competition. TransCanada will fund part of the transaction, the largest in Canada this year, with a $4.2 billion sale of assets to be exchanged for stock when the deal closes. Officials conclude that TransCanada will be offering $25.50 per Columbia share, representing a 32% premium on the average price for the firm over the past 30 days. During a recent conference call, TransCanada CEO Russell Girling was noted saying, quote, "Columbia's asset and growth plans fit very well with our overall strategy of owning and operating highly stable and predictable earnings and cash flow streams." The acquisition, which also includes Columbia's $2.8 billion in debt, will make TransCanada the continent's largest regulated natural gas pipeline company. Shares for TransCanada Corp were down today, closing at $49.08 for a 0.69% loss. Ooh, those cuts were big. Well, that's what investors are saying. SNC-Lavin, a Montreal-based engineering and construction firm, confirmed today that they did indeed cut 950 jobs around the world, including 600 in Canada, in the last 2 months of 2015. The company says that downsizing in Canada will mainly involve employees in Ontario and Alberta, following the elimination of 4,000 positions in 2014, mostly in Quebec. The latest cuts are part of a larger restructuring announced last November by CEO Neil Bruce to adapt to a weaker economy. SNC-Lavin expects to save about $100 million per year from a series of efforts, including workforce reduction. The job loss touched several areas of operations, including the wheat and oil gas sector in the Western Canadian provinces. The company has nearly 40,000 employees around the world, including 12,000 in Canada. Shares for SNC-Lavalin were down today, closing at $46.46 for a 1.48% loss. Did you lend money to Valeant Pharmaceuticals? You may need a glass of water to swallow their latest tough pill. Creditors of Valeant Pharmaceutical Internationals, which have been in violation of lender agreements since Wednesday, are beginning to demand new terms that could further put pressure on the drug maker's business model. Valeant said on Tuesday during earnings call that it would not meet its March 15th deadline for filing its annual financial statements with security regulators. This puts the drug maker in danger of defaulting on its $30 billion debt load. Valeant also announced a sharp reduction in its forecast for its 2016 profits. Shares of the company fell more than 50% on the news early Tuesday morning, cutting its market capitalization to $11.4 billion and deepening concerns for investors about a business model that has largely relied on acquisitions fueled by cheap debt. The company said it had a net loss of $336 million in the final quarter of 2015, rather than a net profit of $462 million, as analysts had expected. Shares have sunk below $35 from a high of $347 back in August, as Valeant has come under further scrutiny for its sharp price hikes in its medications and ties to the disgraced pharmacy Philidor X. Canadian-based shares in Valeant Pharmaceutical Internationals were down today, closing at $34.93 for a 9.64% loss. In other market news, Toronto's S&P-TSX Composite Index was down 0.91% to close at 13,497 points. The broader S&P 500 index stayed relatively flat today, posting a gain of 0.44% to close at 2,049 points. The Nasdaq closed higher today with a gain of 0.24%. In the European markets, the German DAX also closed up today 0.59%. In the Asian indices, the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 1.25%, and the Shanghai Composite Index was up 1.73%. In the commodity markets, gold futures closed flat today at $1,273 an ounce, while April crude futures were down 2.22% to close at $39.35 a barrel. In natural gas, April future contracts were down 2.06% to close at $1.89 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.26%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields were at 1.837%. This has been the Weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. That's our program for today, March 18th. Today's newscast is brought to you by Volunteer Efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Dylan Law. Today's broadcast was produced by Alberto Montoya. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening, and we apologize for any errors we have made today.
Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
And to close off the show, we have The Beast Is Me by Ray Spoon.
Our bodies, we wear armor, we can't. powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
Did you know CITR has an accessibility collective? Our new collective serves to explore issues of inclusion, equity, and accessibility for people with physical and cognitive disabilities on campus and beyond. If you love making radio, listening to radio, or want to get involved for the first time, come join our collective. We include people of all abilities, experience levels, and backgrounds in the production and programming of our show. Tune in to our weekly show, All Access Pass, from 5 to 6 p.m. on Thursdays for interviews, music, news, events, and awesome dialogues. If you want to get involved, email accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. If only I could dream, we could start again.